Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 122. I'm recording it on Thursday, April 16th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. Long-term value proposition. Not short-term, long-term. The music for the podcast is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com, and the title of this selection is Tango di Manzana. The title of the podcast is Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires and Bull Markets. What? I'm going to start with a puzzle. I'm going to put, riddle me this, Batman. What is it the bankers are supposed to have done? We all know that the bankers are very, very bad people. Very, very bad people. And they should be in jail or you know, possibly the electric chair, these people. And they're bad. And we know they're bad because there's, if you did a Google search on the bankers, they, thousands and thousands of articles about how bad they are. We all know they're bad. But I was just wondering the other day, I was reading one of these articles about what we should do to the bankers. And this, you know, I'm inclined to heretical thoughts from time to time, famous for this. And I said, maybe I should send an email. You know, they have those little things nowadays. You can send emails to the authors of the articles. Maybe I should send an email. What is it the bankers did exactly? What is it the bankers did to us? What did they do? Did they, you know, was it like a bankers convention? What was it, September? What was it, September 9th? I don't recall what the day was. It was in September 2008 that the bankers did this thing. And I'm wondering, maybe it was like a bankers convention and they all were together and the bankers, you know, they put on funny glasses and mustaches and they took all our money and they put it in suitcases and they got, you know, phony passports and they, you know, went off to the Riviera or something, right? Those bankers, oh, they'll do it to you every time. They are something. Never trust mama, don't let your children grow up to be bankers. Wall Street bankers. What did they do? Somebody tell me what they did. I've got that contact Rob button there on the left side. I mention it all the time. The left side of the page, of every page at PassionSaving.com. Would someone kindly push that button and tell Rob, old Farmer Hocus, what the bankers did? That we know they're so bad because we didn't think they were that bad before. We didn't think, you know, we weren't really in love with them. I wouldn't say bankers make a lot of money. We weren't exactly crazy about them, but you know, we associated with them. We allowed them to come to our family picnics and, you know, marry our cousins and things of that nature. We weren't too crazy about it. We didn't brag about knowing bankers, but now it's a different story. You don't want to, ain't going to let no bankers come to my picnics, tell you that much. No way. Now send out a little form. If you want to come to the Rob Bennett family picnic, you have to fill out a little form. I promise I am not and have never been a banker. And you have to have it notarized. We're not going to play games because these bankers, they will play games. They'll say, oh, I'm in the consulting field, you know, when they're really a banker and they're just tricking you, you know. It's trickery. That's what's going on. A lot of this going on. I don't think the bankers did anything to us. I'll tell you a funny line, and it's unfair, but it's funny, so it's sort of okay. But that guy, John Stewart, that comedian guy, the public policy comedian, he keeps coming up in public policy debates, supposed to be a comedian. But he had a line, I just saw it somewhere, I picked things up, and he had a line about somebody at one of the banks. This is the early days of the crisis, you know, October, November, and somebody said, well, you know, they were complaining about all the money, these bad bankers, they get so much money, and one of the heads of one of the banks, he says, well, we need to pay them a lot of money, we need to attract the best people. And this John Stewart guy says, you don't get it. You don't get it. You don't have any best people. You don't have any best people. Because, you know, what he's saying is, if you had best people, we wouldn't have this economic crisis. You're the bankers. You're the bad guys. Oh, my. The bankers. The bankers didn't do this to us. I'll say it if nobody else will. The bankers didn't do this to us. Spread the word. Maybe they're bad. You know, I mean, they do make a lot of money. I'll give you that one. So, fine. But they didn't do this to us. But the bankers did. I'll tell you a little bit about it. I've actually read some articles. And I've never seen an article that told us what the bankers were supposed to have done. I'm still waiting for that one. But I read a couple that gave me some clues as to what the problem was. And, you know, the bankers are the scapegoat because what happened on whatever day it was September something. I don't know what the date, no. September 9-1-1, that was a different that was a different September. But this was sometime in, it was, you know, it was when one of those banks failed or something. And that's when the crisis sort of, you know, things have been going bad. That's one of the signs it wasn't the bankers, because things have been going bad for a year. Or things have been going bad since January 2000, to tell the truth. Stock prices from January 2000 through September of 2008, I don't think they went up before the crash. I don't think they had gone up at all. If you go check, They in inflation adjusted terms, they'd gone up a little bit, but if you took inflation out, they hadn't gone up. You know, that's what, 9 years? So, you know, this wasn't something that suddenly happened. Now, and then for a year before the crash, there had been a big high. We had gotten some point in 2008, we had gone way up. And then there had been a year, things had been drifting downwards, and then we just went over a cliff. And we went over the cliff when one of these banks was permitted to fail or something, and everybody said, well, it was all the bankers. Well, the bankers were essentially the fall guys. They were left holding the bag. They're the scapegoats. We're blaming the bankers. They happened to be standing there when everything collapsed, when the big house of cards collapsed. But they didn't tell us to build this house of cards. So they're not, you know, the house of cards had to collapse. They didn't do it. You know, it could have been caused by a gas, you know, price increase. So then we would all be saying, oh, it's all those oil producers did this to us. The oil producers are bad guys. Could have happened on a day of the terrorist attack. That would have scared everybody, and stocks would have fallen 50%. And everybody would say, oh, it's terrorists. It's those bad terrorist people. Those are the people. You could get them. There are no best terrorists. There are no, you know, they ain't got no best people in that terrorism business, John Stewart would be saying. In other words, there could have been a debate, you know, between the candidates, you know, and, you know, oh, you know, McCain and Obama, and McCain looked at his watch or something like George Bush did that time, and they'd say, oh, it's the end of the world. He looked at his watch, you know, it's all over, and everybody'd say, oh, that's the end, and they blame it on that. It's the watchmakers did it to us. The bad watchmakers. Don't be making watches. you think you are, making watches, getting paid money and stuff like that. I better pull it in a little bit. The name of the podcast is Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires and Bull Markets. The bankers did not do this to us. What happened is the bankers were left holding the bag. What happened is if anybody's to get the blame, it should be the economist. They're the bad guys. Now we know it's the economist. The economist came up with this dopey, rational man idea, which led to the efficient market theory, which led to passive investing, which led to the most insane, out-of-control bull market in history, which, of course, naturally, inevitably led to the greatest loss of middle-class wealth in the history of the United States. Blame the economist, why don't you? Those guys, I knew they were up to no good from day one. I signed up for Econ 101, and they handed out that Samuelson book, and it was this big, heavy thing. And I'll tell you, this was a clue. If you were paying attention, like I was, you would have known. That Samuelson book, they were using that book in Econ 101 for about 50 years, and you could have gotten a used copy for about $1.25, and they put out a new edition every single year, just so that dopes like me would pay for the new edition, because they would change the order of the chapters and stuff, and you wouldn't know what your assignment was. They'd say chapter 6, and you'd be doing chapter 13 if you had an old one. So you had to buy a new one, which cost about like $30 or something. So you're going to tell me these economists are on the up and up, these economist types? No. They're the bad guys. Economist types. The bankers. It's not that I love bankers. That's not the point here. And they do, frankly, get paid too much. They get paid. Oh, you compare bankers and journalists? That we used to have I'm going to get to the point. But I used to work at a place called Daily Tax Report. I loved my job. It's a long time ago. I was young and frisky. But I used to go to lunch at a place called Dove and Rainbow. I don't know if it's still there. It was sort of near Georgetown, just before you got into Georgetown on M Street, about two blocks before Georgetown. And there was some kind of finance thing there. It was a brokerage or what it was, banking, probably bankers, I don't know. But bad people. It was clearly bad people. Because you know how you knew they were bad? They wore suits. You knew they were bad. I never wore no suits. I wore jackets, but not suits. These people were bad people. And, I'm there on my journalist salary, and I'd go in there, and I used to love to get a chef salad, and they had some kind of chocolate cake, and that was my thing, and orange juice. Chef salad and a big orange juice and a chocolate cake, and I'd read the New Republic or something. Those were the days. But these guys would come in, and they were selling stocks to people, and I'd always just sort of, I knew they were bad. I lost my point. But anyway, I don't really think they're bad. The point was we used to eat at the same restaurant, and these guys, I spent a lot of money on those lunches. I'd spend $10 sometimes, but I just did it because I wanted to have a place to go off and read, get a break out of my day. But these guys, they were just spending money, and you knew they were bad. If they spend money, they had to be bad people. But I don't think they were really all so bad. I had the feeling some of them had girlfriends, and some of them had mothers. I mean, you just never know with people. You check them out, you never know. Some of them might not have been all bad. But they do make too much money. I will sign a statement saying they make too much money. You can write me up on that. But I don't think they caused the economic crisis. So what did cause it? What did cause it if it wasn't the bankers? Well, as I say, it was this idea. It was this idea that it was economists that came up with it. So if you're going to blame somebody, blame them. And it was this idea of rational man. And what it comes down to is when they try to understand how the economy works, they say, well, everybody's rational. Everybody wants to, you know, make as much money as they can and not lose as, and avoid losing as much as they can. And then they model the whole world on this. They do. And I'm not, I don't make this stuff up. I don't. I, you know, check it out. Check, Google it. Check it out. You'll see what I'm telling you. It holds up. It's, some of it's hard to believe, but it's you know, it's verifiable. Document it. They really do this. They say, oh, everybody's just, you know. I remember my dad said that once. I shouldn't go on and on, but we were watching television, and he said, or you know, maybe he was reading his newspaper or something. He said, I think we were watching something on television. I forget what it was. It was some development in history, and he said, oh, it's always economics. You know, it's always like money. It's always the thing that changes the world. You know, people are looking for a cure or something. They want to make money. And I just knew when he said it that it was significant, and I thought it was wrong, but I didn't know why. And it's certainly true that money is a driver. It's a motivator. So it's one of those statements that's half true, and it's true enough that it takes you in. But if you really dig, if you wanted to put a list of 20 things that have happened in the world because of money, it would be very easy to come up with such a list. In other words, people say the oil, you know, they'll say the war with Iraq was over oil. And I don't know. I haven't researched it. I don't know. But I'm sure that it was a factor. I just don't have any doubt in my mind. But I don't think it was the only factor. I don't believe that. I'm sure people say, you know, all these people talk about John Kennedy. Why did he get killed? And I'll bet some of the theories have to do with money, you know, money. I mean, the mafia killed him, you know, because he was going to shut down their operations, you know, their, it was Bobby Kennedy that I think the mafia didn't like, but they were going after his brother, I guess. But the point is that you can look at all kinds of things and say, money, money, money is the driver. And, you know, pretty good chance you'll be proven right. It's often true. But then, if you wanted to make a list of 20 things that happened in history that made no sense from a money standpoint, you can do that. I mean, did we go to the moon for money? I mean, it cost an awful lot of money to get to the moon. Did we do that? There is money that came out of it, you know, and I haven't studied it. But I am sure that there are inventions and things. In other words, when they built these rockets, when the government built these rockets, it led to new knowledge about chemicals and interactions and compounds, you know, new kinds of steel. I don't know. And so probably some people made money from Tang. Tang came out of it, right? Think where Tang would be if it hadn't been for the Apollo mission. There'd be no Tang company. Multi-billion dollar business, you know, they make like $1 billion a day in Tang sales. you know, Lucky Charms probably came out of that. So, I mean, you gotta be serious about this stuff. It's all about money, but it's not all about money because there's a certain romance in going to the moon and, you know, we wanted to beat the Russians And part of it that shows it probably wasn't really all money is that they sort of stopped it after that. I mean, they still do moon missions, but not as many. So if it was a big moneymaker, they'd keep doing it. So I think there was something more than money there. I think money was a factor. I think they could. A lot of times you can't do something unless it brings in some money. That's the way I would put it. If it's totally a money loser, the odds are against you. And if you can go to producers and say, hey, this is going to make a lot of money, you're set. And, but it's not, I remember, but it's not all money. I remember when somebody told me, you know, The Passion, the Mel Gibson movie, Passion of the Christ. And I don't know, it made like, right, millions, right? It's one of the most, I mean, it sold like more tickets than, it's like in the top 10 of all time, you know. And I remember somebody coming to me about a year before it came out, and they said, oh, Mel Gibson's making this movie, and it's about the last 12 hours, you know, of Jesus' life, and It's all in this. Arabic or something, some kind of language. I don't even know what it's called, but some language, and it's not gonna have subtitles. You know, you're not gonna. And I just looked at the person like, "Are you Looney Tunes? Nobody's gonna go to that movie." I said, first of all, how many people are there, first of all, they're going to go to a religious movie? I mean, just between you and me, you know, how many people? And then secondly, it's not exactly what you call a date movie, you know, so that's like a negative. And, there's not going to be a whole lot of funny lines in it. This is not going to be Annie Hall. And Mel Gibson's not going to star in it, right? I mean, he's directing. He's not starring. We all know how it turns out. You know, there's no plot suspense. We all know how it turns out. And then we're not going to be able to understand any of the words. Oh, boy. Well, little did I know. Little did I know. So it's, you know, but I don't think he did that for money. I don't think he did that for money. And he got money. Now, afterwards, people did say, oh, he just did it for the money. But come on. Come on. He didn't do it for the money. But he did make some money, which is, you know, I think that's fine. But anyway, the point is people don't do things just for money as a rule. A lot of times they do. Some people do. Now, why was I talking about that? Why did I care? I'm going to have to get serious. I really, this is just out of control. I want to talk about the subject of this blog, Rob, my friend, is Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires and Bull Markets. Oh, the bankers. People want to say that the bankers just did this for the money. And it's like this simple-minded cartoon version of reality. And that's just not the way the world works. And it's important, okay? I am telling jokes, but let's be serious now. It's important. First of all, we have to know why this happened to us if we want to recover from it. We have to know why it happened. That's important. It's like a prescription. It's like when you go to a doctor, he doesn't just start bouncing ideas off you. He doesn't, you know, you come in and you say, I got an upset stomach. Oh, good, let's give you an MRI, you know, and... but doctor, my throat is sore. Oh, well, we'll do brain surgery. I mean, you know, you got to figure out why is your throat sore? Why do you got an upset stomach? And then you decide what the prescription is. So we have to know why this happened. And there have been thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of articles written. And not a few of them have talked about why it happened. Well, there's a certain percentage talked about why it happened and get it all mixed up. And then a lot don't even talk about it at all. They just assume the bankers did it. And then there's a few that seem to actually come pretty close to getting it right, but they don't go into enough depth to make a difference as a rule. There's been some good stuff written. More good stuff in the past 6 months than the prior 6 years. That's for sure. So there's been good stuff. I don't want to say nobody's doing good stuff. But... you know, we could do better, and we need a prescription. And I wish we hadn't gone about this process of passing all the legislation first and then having the hearings to figure out what went wrong. You know, we should have maybe did it the other way around. You know, maybe the hearings first, figure out why this happened, and then craft the legislation. And of course, the political imperative was you got to do it now, get the economy going. And politically, of course, that's just fine. Makes everybody happy, but the trouble is we're spending the money probably on the wrong things because we don't know what we did. We don't know why it happened. And what I'm getting afraid of as time goes on, it's now, is it 7 months? 7 months, I think. Now I'm getting afraid we're going to forget the question. What was it that happened again? Something about bankers? Oh, what happened? The Economist. It wasn't the bankers that I was talking about, the money riff. It was the Economist. The Economists say that the people selling us these overpriced textbooks, what they say is, we're all about money. We're money machines. We're just money robots. And we calculate. Oh, do we ever calculate? And the funny thing, of course, is they claim that we calculate everything. This is what the economists, and I swear they say this, please. This part's not a joke. They say we calculate our self-interest. And most of us don't even know how to calculate. That's the sad, pathetic part. I don't know how to calculate stuff. And you probably don't. Maybe the economists do. So they're talking about themselves. They do all this rational man junk. But none of the rest of us do. The rest of us are like, some of us don't even know what the word rational means. How could we be rational? We don't even know what it means. We're not calculating anything. We're just, we're watching television and they tell us what to do. And then we do it. That's it. They wouldn't lie to us. I don't even know who the people are anymore who tell us. But we don't calculate our self-interest. There was a good story. I mentioned this book that I read the other night, Animal Spirits, Robert Schiller and this man, Akerlof. And they had a good story there. We're talking about saving, which is another interest of mine. I'd like to get back to talking about saving a little bit sometime. And they talked about in their classroom, the economists say, oh, we all determine how much to save because we do these calculations. And we say, oh, I should be saving 9.3%, but my friend over there, he's in different circumstances. He should be saving 11.2%. And if they lower interest rates, it'll change my calculation. So instead of saving 9.3%, I'll be saving 9.7%. But my friend, who's now saving 11.3%, is only going to be saving 11.1%. And is my increase to 9.7% going to correlate and make up for his drop to 11.1%? Oh, well, you'll have to get a calculator and a slide rule to figure that out. And then the politicians will have to decide if it's too risky a strategy. Oh. This is the idiocy. People get paid to do this stuff, not small amounts of money, and not one or two people. There's like kajillions of them. And the point the guy was making, Schiller and Akerlof, they were saying, we asked the students in the class, and like they didn't make any of these calculations. In other words, you could double the return on their money. And of course, employers have done it. They have matches for the 401ks. They could double it. And it wouldn't change the saving rate a little bit, maybe. There's a few there, the frugal people who'll save more. But of course, most of them are saving all they can anyway. So increasing it wouldn't change it because under the rules, they can only put in so much. So, giving them a bigger match wouldn't matter. They're already getting the maximum match. But the 90% of us who don't save anything, you could offer us, a match of 1,000 times and we're not going to do it because they don't even read the papers. They don't even know what the match is. But these economists have them all, and I know this because I was one of them. And these economists have them all calculating everything. It's idiotic. And what people don't understand, that's what caused this crash, okay? I know this. I checked. You could take my word for it. I tell you sometimes, don't believe anything Rob Bennett says. This one I want you to just take my word. Don't even check it out. I know. No, that's it. It's an idiotic idea. I mean, it's not idiotic, depends how you mean idiotic. I mean, it's idiotic in that it's wrong and it's dumb, but it led to a lot of thinking that was actually sort of good. In other words, there is a half-truth there. You do have to look at the calculations. The calculations are not a waste of time. They do tell you things. The way to think about it, the way I think about it is, humans are partly intellectual and partly emotional. And what the economists do, you see, the economists all have science envy. You've heard of penis envy. Well, the economists have science envy. They all want to be scientists. They think, because economics involves numbers, they think, oh, we should be like physicists, we should be respected members of the academy, And nobody thinks they're scientists, nobody's fooled, but they think if they carry around slide rules, people will start thinking they're really physicists. And so they never like to, this is why they don't like to talk about people, because if they talk about people, people could say, what are you? You're like in the English lit department? What are you? Talk about people, motivation, and narratives, stories. What? You know, scientists. So they don't want that. That would blow their deal. So they try to play up the science side of economics. And there is a science side. It does exist. There's no harm in pointing it out. There's really no harm in this stuff if you just don't take it too seriously. As long as you understand that the science part, the numbers part, is, I say, roughly 30%. Now, if somebody wants to say 50%, I'm not going to argue with you. I don't know if it's 30 or 50. I just say 30 because that's like one-third. And that makes the part that I talk about twice as important as the part they talk about. So that, you know, that works for me. So that's where I came up with that. You know, that's how I came up with that number. You see how much effort we put into the numbers we use? 30%, I say. But these economist people, they act like it's 100%. Now, people would say, so what? Why are you, Rob, 31 minutes you're talking and all you're telling me is about economists? Who cares? I don't care about economists. I care about my stock money. I lost all my money. Get it back for me, man. I can get it back for you. If I explain to you how stock investing works, and if it clicks, you can go to my website. There's a calculator there, the investment strategy tester, and it tells you a different way to invest, valuation-informed indexing, not passive investing. And it tells you that the odds are in 30 years, you will have recovered all of the money you lost in this crash. Plus, you'll still get your regular return that you would have gotten from passive investing for the next 30 years. In other words, over the next 30 years, if you switch today, you'll get all the money you would get if you just stayed with passive, plus enough to make up for all of your losses. So I can, there's a practical side to this Rob Bennett individual. But you've got to get this other part first. Otherwise, it won't click. And if it doesn't click, you're not going to use the calculator and none of the good stuff happens. So you've got to listen to me. Even, you know, and all my stupid jokes. I'm sorry. This is the way it is. Into every life, a little rain must fall. The economist, why does it matter? Isn't it just an academic thing? Isn't it just people talking in a classroom? No, because what happens is businesses, they have to make decisions about what to buy and how much to pay their workers. And they, God bless them, but they go to these economist types. And of course, we do the same thing. We don't care about the economist, right? We all agree, right? Nobody cares. And people, if you talk to people at parties, they'll say, well, I don't believe in theory. I want to know what works. I'm not interested. Fine, you don't believe in theory. But the truth is you do, because when the so-called practical man who doesn't believe in theory, what he ends up doing is when it's time to set his stock allocation, he says, oh, I'm a practical man. I don't believe in theory. What does John Bogle recommend? John Bogle's a wealthy man. I will see what John Bogle does. I want to be a wealthy man. Also, I will do what John Bogle tells me to do. Well, guess what? John Bogle's following a theory. So all you're doing is you're following a theory secondhand. You're doing the same. You're following a theory like everybody else. You just don't know what the theory is. For you, the theory is John Bogle following. But it comes to the same thing. You're following a theory. You're following this egghead idea that of the rational man, which translates in the practical realm to passive investing. That's what you're doing, like it or not. That's the story. So I've got to explain to you why that theory is dopey and why it causes you to lose all your money. And I better do it before another 30 minutes passes, because I'm going to get in trouble if these things keep running over 60 minutes. It's unacceptable. Everybody's following this theory. The people buying stocks are following this theory, this rational man theory. That's where passive investing comes from. Everything's calculated. We're all rational. Markets, that's why you can't beat the market, because we're all rational. And if we're all rational, the market price is always right, and there's no way you can time the market. Can't be done. Nobody's ever shown this to be true. Please understand. It's pure theory. It's not, in fact, the evidence is it's never been true. going back to the beginning of time. No one's ever found a time when this was true. But the theory says it must be true, so gosh darn it, that's what we're going to tell people. And it always causes stock crashes. Now, the bankers are just like you and me, except they're richer. You know, they are richer. So it is fair to say they're bad people. I'm okay with that. But, you know, we have to keep it in limits. They're just like you and me. So what they do is they have these things, you know, these debt securitize, embogalize, democratizal, Binghamton theoretical, blockle, meckle things. And they mix all the money in there. When you send the money, you know, you write them checks, and they just send it in there. And it securitizes and boggleizes it. And that's all they do. That's what they're there for. They develop software that securitizes and boggleizes. And they have to go to school to do that. You know, that's the thing. You have to go to school. And you have to take hard courses. You can't take, you know, English Lit. You got to take, like, I don't know, calculus or something, you know. So you and me don't have to worry about it. But that's why they make all this money. Because they did this. They took calculus and, you know, they earned it. So anyway, they do the same thing. So they're assuming, they're making all their decisions about who gets loans and who can buy houses and all this, who can start businesses, based on all the securitize and boggleize. And all of that stuff is just more of this efficient market baloney. So what's going on is the purpose of a banker is to evaluate risk, okay? Assess risk. That's it. That's what they do. And they're using a theory that doesn't work. It looks at 30% of the question. It ignores 70%. So what do you think their risk assessment? How hot do you think their risk assessment? They're all wrong. Their risk assessments are wrong. So naturally, it all collapses, okay? But the bankers are no more to blame than you are. If you bought stocks from 1995 to 2008, you did the same thing they did. You took on an insane risk for very little potential return. And you didn't think you don't think you're a bad person, do you? You're not a bad person. I know this. So you're not bad. The bankers aren't bad. Nobody's bad. Now, I wanted this to be a different theme, so I've got to discipline myself. This is supposed to be a positive theme. It's called "Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires and Bull Markets," and I wrote a blog entry on this, a guest blog entry, and I got two comments, and that's what made me want to do the podcast, because the comments were from two smart people who were doubting me, and so I thought it was worth sort of, you know, doing a little riff now. The idea, only you can prevent forest fires, what that means is, you know, Smokey the Bear used to come out and say, only you can prevent forest fires on television. And why did he do that? Well, I take it that the idea was that these forest fires were getting started and, you know, people would sort of be taking a walk through the woods and they would just flick their cigarette, you know, and walk away and they'd not think about it. And then the cigarette would catch fire and the whole forest would burn down. And, you know, how do you deal with such a problem? Nobody's doing it intentionally. Nobody wants to burn the forest down. I mean, in some cases they did. But the ones who were burning it down on purpose, they weren't listening to the television commercials with Smokey the Bear. The Smokey the Bear was aimed at just the average person who just carelessly flicks a cigarette, you know, or lights a campfire and doesn't put it out properly, doesn't, you know, throw water on it. So these commercials were trying to educate the public. Don't do that, okay? And it was worth spending money because these forest fires cost a lot of money to put out, and you got to rebuild the forest and all this sort of thing. Well, that's what we've got with bull markets. The U.S. economy is sufficiently productive to generate a return on stocks, a broad index, of about 6.5% real per year. Very nice return. No problem. That's been true for a long time. That's the average return. As long as we get 6.5% a year, everything's groovy. We put our 401k money in stocks, we get a return of 6.5, and all of those calculations that you've looked at, you know, in the newspaper that tell you you're on track to retire at 65 or 70 or whatever it is, they all work. So everything's great. Now, the trouble is, in the 1990s, the stocks didn't go up 6.5. They went up 20, 30% a year, okay? And so the money doesn't come out of the sky. The money gets borrowed from future returns when that happens. So when you have a return of 30%, what's happening is you're getting 6% genuine return on you know, generated by businesses, and 24% phony baloney return, which is borrowed from the future. And we did that year after year after year. And then what happens is, by January 2000, stocks were valued 3 times fair value, which meant we're going to go years with negative returns. You know, 10 years, 15 years, bad stuff. And when we have those bad returns for 15 years, all of us freak out because there's no money in our accounts, because we were expecting to make 6.5. That's what all the calculators told us. And we're not making it. We're making a negative whatever. This year, like negative 50, whatever it is. And so we stop spending. We stop buying houses and cars and vacations. And then all the companies go out of business. And then we've got a depression. So maybe we want to stop doing that. That's the thought. That's the thought at PassionSaving.com. Maybe it's not such a hot idea after all. Well, how do you stop it? You can't stop it after the crash getting mad at the bankers. That doesn't do any good. They didn't cause it, and they can't stop it. There's nothing they can do. You can torture them if you want, but they don't have any information to give up. They don't know anything. They genuinely don't know anything, so torture them all you like, and you're not going to get anything out of them, okay? But what we could do is we could apply the same logic that we used to stopping forest fires. In other words, we could educate people how stock investing really works, which it's the opposite of the passive model. The passive model says, which is the conventional advice of the last 30 years, the passive model says, never worry about price, always stick the same stock allocation. When stocks are fair priced, you decide on a certain risk level and say you go with a 70% stock allocation. And then when risk is 5 times greater because prices have gone up, hey, you take on 5 times greater risk. Don't adjust that stock allocation. Just, you know, sure, you can't afford that risk and you're probably going to, you know, destroy your hopes for retirement. But hey, you got to be passive, don't you? You know, you're in the Pepsi generation. You want to be sociable. So I'm thinking it's not such a good idea. I'm thinking maybe we should tell people the realities of stock investing, that stocks are much more dangerous at high prices than they are at fair prices. And that the way to do this is we need to educate. We need to spread the word. And John Russell, my partner in developing the calculators, he put a comment up at my blog and said, fine. He says, nice piece. But he says there's a lot of institutional power behind this. You know, promoting passive investing. These companies, they want people to invest passively because they get regular checks. You know, people just put in checks every week. And how are you going to overcome that? And the other guy said, well, the Silicon Investor guy, he writes a blog. Silicon Prairie, it's called, his blog. And he wrote a thing, and he said, it's not going to be enough to tell people to sell their stocks. If you'd have to have people shorting the market to have enough impact, because only a small number of people that are buying like crazy can send prices up. And I don't really agree, but you know, there's a lot of historical data supporting them. We've done this to ourselves 4 times, so you would think we would have learned the first 3 times. We sure didn't. So I have to say, there's, you know, the comment he's making is well put. I don't personally buy into it, but I see his point. So my answer is, to John, yes, there is institutional power. The stock selling industry wants us to invest passively, and part of it, I think, is that they genuinely don't understand the realities. They believe, I think some of them, a lot of them, believe this efficient market theory stuff. They know there's holes in it. I can tell they know there's holes in it. But I think they're engaging in cognitive dissonance. They know there are holes, but they don't want to know how bad the holes are. So they block. They don't listen. They don't want to know. But there's no question that the financial pressures, they make so much money, millions and millions of dollars. that they're pressured to promote this stuff. It is a problem. So John's making a valid point. So what's the answer? Well, I compare it to pollution. Say we have a problem with companies that have factories and the you know, they're burning off all kinds of, you know, they're causing pollution, the smokestacks. And, you know, if they paid for some filters, it would reduce the pollution, say, in half. But they'd be incurred an expense for that. What's going to happen? Well, if you write nice little articles in the newspaper saying, you know, it'd be nice if you companies got this filter, not too many are going to do it. And the reason is, a lot of them are good people. I don't buy any argument that starts off by saying large numbers of people are just flat out bad. I'm always skeptical of, because it doesn't match my personal experience. Now, any argument that says all people are good also gets red flagged. My experience with people is that, you know, there are some that are, you know, just bad. You know, there are some, and there are some who are saintly. There are some like that, but those are rare. And most people are in the middle. Most people try to be good, but, you know, they eat an extra piece of chocolate cake when you're not looking every now and again. That's most of us. So say you're one of those. Chances are the guys owning the business and the women, that's what they're into. Well, if they pay for the filter, they know the other guy's not going to pay for the filter. The other company across the street that's also making bowling balls or whatever it is they make. So they say, if I pay for that filter, every bowling ball I sell is going to cost me a dime more. So I'm going to have to charge a dime more, and nobody's going to buy my bowling balls, because they're going to say, what? What would I, what do I want to pay that dime extra bowling ball for? I want the cheaper ball, the dime less bowling ball. I'm not stupid. I'm not going to pay 10 cents extra for a bowling ball. Not going to buy your bowling ball. So you're going to go out of business. So the guy doesn't want to go out of business. He's, you know, his wife, you know, she likes it that he, you know, they can pay the mortgage, you know, and if he goes out of business, it's all over. So, you know, he likes her. He wants to keep her. So he says no to the filter. Now, if you pass a law that says if you don't install this filter, you know, you go to jail, well, that changes it. You see? That changes it. Now he buys the filter. So I don't want to, I want to hang out with my wife, and if I go to jail, she'll only be allowed to visit once a week, and it doesn't work, and, you know? So you change it. The point is, you know, things are not hopeless. There are things we can do. We are, humans are the ones with the power. We're the humans. These economists don't control us. They control us today because we all bought into their dopey ideas, but they don't have the power. We have the power. If we impose a bowling ball tax, we can get those filters installed. We could do this. So this is what I'm promoting. I'm saying we all, of course, the first step is we can't get the bowling ball tax passed without getting, you know, a consensus. Everybody's got to want this. But there's nobody that is hurt by the switch to rational investing. It's a win-win-win-win-win. Everybody wins. And you know, the suggestion in John's comment is that the institutional forces, the mutual funds, aren't going to want to do it. But I don't really think that's true. It's true in the short term they don't want to do it because their necks are on the line. If one mutual fund does it, they're gonna lose. If the economists call this the tragedy of the commons, there's no one who benefits from sweeping the common area. No one. So it doesn't get done. It turns into a pigsty. But if you collect a little fee from everybody that's got a little apartment, and then you hire a board to, you know, hire somebody to sweep the floor in the commons, it gets done. So we've all got to work together. We want an attractive commons area. We all want that. We don't want to have these crashes. These crashes don't help mutual funds. Now people are scared of stocks. It doesn't help them. So I think it can be done. But I think it has to start outside of the stock selling industry. The stock selling industry isn't going to impose this on itself. It has to be the average person saying, hey, I don't like it that I lost all my 401k money. I'm fed up. I'm going to go to a discussion board. I'm going to say, let's allow honest posting on these discussion boards. Let's start sharing ideas. Let's organize. Let's unite. Let's write our congressmen and congresswomen, and let's get some things done. And it can be done. I'm sure when that woman, I don't know her name, Rachel somebody, wrote the book Silent Spring, about pollution or the environment. Everybody, read the first draft, said, oh, it was very sweet, Rachel, but, it's not practical. Nobody's gonna install filters. I mean, Rachel, there are no filters today, and there never will be filters, and no one's ever gonna recycle their trash. This is naive thinking. People do all kinds of things, but they don't do them until somebody stands up and says, "Let's start doing them." So, I think it's tragedy of the commons, and I don't think a lot of these experts are really opposed to it. I think a lot of them like the idea. They'd love to tell us the truth about stock investing. I won't go on and on about it, but I presented evidence, I think, and I had a podcast. It's not a conspiracy. It's cognitive dissonance. And, you can read these guys. They write a chapter of their book that tells the straight story. Why would they do that if they're just bad? They're not bad people. They're good people who are being pressured to do bad things. And if we relieve that pressure, they'd be thanking us. But they can't do it. They can't step forward. We've got to step forward. We've got to help them out. And then they'll get on board. But we all need to think about it, not about what's in it for me, not about how do I get my retirement money back. In other words, I want you to get your retirement money back, but you've got to care about the community as a whole to make it happen. If you care about the community as a whole, we will all work together and we'll all get our retirement money back. What's going on here is it's a social-wide problem. It's not just you who lost your retirement money. It's all of us. We all can fix it if we all work together, but we've all got to get on the program. And the same thing is basically true with the point that Silicon Prairie made. The point I would make there is he's thinking about things in terms of the way they are now, and he's saying this isn't going to be enough. Telling people passive investing doesn't work is not going to be enough, and that's true. What we need is a total switch in thinking. See, people are being too moderate. We need drastic change, big revolutionary change. And the trick is, an example I gave in my answer to him, I said we would have to have the president of the country, when the PE 10 level went above 20, the president should be going on national television saying, my fellow Americans, you're messing up again. I read my history books and I remember what happened in September of 2008. We destroyed our economy with this nonsense last time. Never again. I want you, as your patriotic duty, to march down to your mutual fund tomorrow and sell half of your stocks and get that P10 level back below 20. Do it now. And enough of us would do it. We would get the P10 level down. Because all the rest, the ones who didn't want to do it would be scared. They'd say, I'm going to lose my money. Stocks are going to be dropping. And so everyone would want to do it. And then once everyone did it, he could get back on television 2 days later and say, all right, you did it. I told you to get it down to 18, and it's down to 3. So it can ease up now, and then everybody would buy back, and it would be back at 16 or whatever, The point is, you don't let it get above 20. You don't let it get above 20, you don't have a problem. The problem that we have 30 years of research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. That's not an issue. That's not an intellectual issue. The problem is, what people do is they wait until it's a crisis. I think what happened is the passive people, they were trying to promote passive investing, and passive investing has a lot of good in it. As much as I criticize it, there's a lot of good ideas in it. And in the package, the passive idea of not changing your stock allocation is pure evil. But the package has a lot of good in it. The idea of tuning out the market noise and keeping transaction costs low and sticking to your plan, all that stuff is good. Indexing's good. The bad part is this idea of not changing your allocation in response to big price changes. That's bad. That's evil. But what happened is they said they wanted, I think what happened, I don't know, I can't get into their heads, but I think what happened is they wanted to market this and they wanted to keep it simple and they wanted to appeal to people's get rich quick impulse. You know, see, all marketing is emotion. And my guess is they did marketing tests and they said, hey, let's test some slogans. And they did these slogans and they said, timing doesn't work. Oh, people respond to that. They like that. Because you see, that sounds prudent. Telling people timing doesn't work, it makes people believe in your product. It sounds like you're a straight shooter. Like, you're telling something they don't want to hear. They really want to hear timing doesn't work. Because timing doesn't work means you can invest heavily in stocks when they're insanely overpriced. That's what we all want to do. That's the get-rich-quick impulse. But it sounds good. And so it's a great marketing slogan. Horrible investing advice, but wonderful marketing slogan. So they did that, and I think they justified it. They said, hey, prices aren't that high. When passive investing was getting off the ground, prices were very low. And they said, this isn't going to hurt anybody. You know, they should be heavily invested in stocks. Most people don't have enough in stocks. We're helping them, if anything. And they never imagined we would ever go above 20 again, because then we were at 7. And then by the time we got up to 20, probably some of them started saying, do you think we should mention that, you know, long-term timing does work? And they said, well, I don't know. The guy down the street, they're promoting passive and they're making millions. And if we do that, we're not going to have any customers because everybody's into the get-rich-quick stuff now. And it's a little late now. We maybe should have mentioned that 20 years ago. But, you know, yeah, I guess I want to keep my job too. I guess I will keep quiet or look for a different line of work. If you're going to teach people the truth about stock investing, you have to do it you got to do it permanently. You can't do it. You can't say, we're not going to mention it until it goes above 20, and then all of a sudden, we're going to tell you everything we told you before is wrong. You've got to make it a practice. It's got to become a habit. Thinking about price has to become a habit. And when it becomes a habit, it'll work. You know, in other words, if people every day are using the calculators, every day, they're not going to forget that prices matter. If people every day are going on discussion boards and getting that message drilled in, timing always works, 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 they'll get it. That's how you advertise on television. Four out of five dentists recommend Crest. Four out of five dentists recommend Crest. Four out of five dentists. You got to say it over and over and over and over and over again. That's what people remember. That's what you got to hit emotional buttons and you got to have repetition. And we've done that in the investing field. Unfortunately, we taught all the wrong lessons. We taught people to give into their get-rich-quick impulse for 30 years. So we created a mess. But we can use those same tactics, those same tools to teach people the realities. And when we do that, it's a different world. Because then when people try to trick them and say, hey, you know, maybe timing doesn't work. Maybe you should, you know, maybe stocks are always best. They'll say, right, buddy. Good point. Stocks are always best for the long run. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm gonna invest my retirement money in that idea. See, you want to get people emotionally on your side. You want to get people emotionally on your side. That's the game. It's the game. That's the job, I should say. I mean, whether you think about it as a game or a job. But that's the goal. That's the goal. And some will say, well, that's impossible. How are we ever going to make this big change? Well, it is hard. There are institutional forces. The biggest problem is this I was wrong question. We've got 90% of the big name experts have been telling us the wrong thing for 30 years. How are we going to get them all to admit they were wrong? That's the rub. That's the rub. But there's an opportunity. You know, we're in a crisis. Well, what's the word crisis? The word crisis signifies something. It means everything's up for grabs. People are talking about changing our system of government. They're talking about, you know, trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see. These things weren't on the table, you know, a few years ago. Now they are. So If we can make those kinds of changes, I think we can make change. We may need an amnesty. You know, I believe we need an amnesty. You know, protect people who promote it, passive investing, from lawsuits. But with an so what? They're good people. They're smart people. We want them working, you know, to help us. So we grant them an amnesty. So what? Doesn't, you know, it's going to cost us anything? Save the economy? It's worth it. So we can have a fresh start. We need to stop, but of course we need to stop looking for villains. This is why I started out by talking about the bankers. There's a method to my madness. I don't just, you know, the jokes always have a point. I don't always remember what it is, but it's there somewhere. The point was, stop looking for villains. You hurt yourself with that stuff. I had a podcast, The Good Populism, The Bad Kind of Pop. The Good Kind of Populism, The Bad Kind of Populism. Populism, if populism means let's get together as a community, you know, and save our retirements, yes, that populism is gold. Let's do it. If the populism is let's hang, you know, somebody from a tree, you know, what did John Lennon say? You're going to have to, all I can tell you is, buddy, count me out if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you know. It's not about hanging people from a tree. So let's get past that, please. Let's talk real. I mean, people may really do it. I don't want to say it's not real, but it's you know, it's not the right way to go. He who was without sin cast the first stone. He who bought no stocks from 1995 through 2008, you know, point to the first scapegoat. And Rob Bennett can't do it because I bought him in 95. I got out in 96, but I'm guilty in 95. And I think the world has changed. I think all the arguments people have for why we can't do this, you know, it's historically it hasn't been done. So people feel, well, it can't be. If it could be done, somebody would have done it. But the world changes. And today, the big change is that middle class people are trying to finance retirements with stocks. And if you're gonna tell people to finance their retirements, you're gonna have to tell them how stock investing works. I'm sorry, but you know, I don't care how many institutional pressures you've got going the other way. It has to be done. It just doesn't work. The way I always say it about the campaign of terror against our, you know, the retire early indexing communities, I say, okay, here's what you're telling me. John Graney got an important number wrong in a study people used to plan their retirements, right? And he very, 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 very much does not want to acknowledge it, right? And your conclusion is no one's ever going to talk about what the numbers really say on the internet for the rest of all recorded time. That's the idea. I'd say, okay, you know, good point, drip guy. Good point there, Schroeder. Good point. We're never going to talk about how stock investing works again. The world has changed. There's too much riding on this to keep up with the silliness. We've got to get serious. And getting serious means we give people accurate retirement numbers. And once we correct those retirement studies, passive investing just collapses because passive investing got the retirement numbers wrong. That's what investment advice is all about, how to plan your retirement. If they got that wrong, they got it all wrong. And they didn't get it wrong by a little bit. They got it wildly wrong. So any investing model, and they didn't correct it for 7 years after it was made public, any investing model that gets the numbers wrong for 7 years, doesn't fix them, is an investing model headed for the trash heap of history, in Rob Bennett's opinion. In Rob Bennett's humble opinion. And, you know, people do care. And people can understand this stuff. A lot of people will say, I'm going to do a separate podcast. Are we too dumb to understand investing? This is something the experts will say from time to time. Rob, you know, you're idealistic, but, you know, people aren't. They don't understand. You know, they're emotional. Well, yes, they are emotional. Are they emotional because they're just built that way? Or are they emotional because they've tried to swallow this passive investing junk and they can't make heads or tails out of it? It doesn't make any sense. The reason most people are emotional about investing is they're trying to follow a model that doesn't add up. Have you ever tried it the other way? I have. I have an article at my site, Community Comments on the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate Debate. It's in the Banned at Motley Fool section where people at Motley Fool were talking about this stuff in the early days before the goons got too out of control. And a lot of people loved it. And a lot of people understood it. They didn't understand it in full. I didn't understand it in full. And I don't understand it in full today, I don't think. But they got the idea. And they liked learning. They loved learning. They loved it. So I don't buy this idea that we can't. I don't buy this idea that people are too dumb. And I don't buy the idea that people are too emotional. And I don't buy the idea that people don't care. People need to ask questions. People need to ponder the ideas. But we can bring them around. And people do care. What's really, you know, people care about the environment, don't they? Do you not see a change? People don't throw trash out their window. People recycle their trash. You know, people go to these, we don't do everything. I mean, people try to get fuel-efficient cars. People do lots of things. We don't do it all right, by any stretch, not even close. But it's not right to say people don't care a lot. And a lot of advertisers have picked up on this. They know that people care. I mean, Apple Computer does this. They've got something out now. They say the green computer, whatever. I don't even know what they're talking about. But they're obviously trying to sell to people who care about the environment. So they know it's emotional hot button. Well, guess what? Financial freedom's an emotional hot button. People love the idea. We can sell the realities of stock investing by touching that emotional button. We can have, and this is the point of the title of the podcast, what we need are television commercials. We don't need long articles, boring, you know, with charts and tables, and God bless us all. I mean, you've got to have that stuff to persuade the experts. It's got to be out there. You've got to back up your claims. But to get the average person on, we've got to do some television commercials with Smokey the Bear in them. Only you can prevent forest fires and bull markets. The of course, the implicit message there is that bull markets are bad. That's the key. We want people to hate bull markets. We want people to hiss at the movie screen when a newspaper headline comes out saying stocks went up 25% this year. Boo! Those irresponsible people. Those bad people. Those bad politicians that didn't protect the people and allowed that to happen. Boo! That's it. When we hear people booing big jumps in the Dow, we're there, friend. We're where we want to be. Bull markets are over, which means bear markets are over, which means stock crashes are over, which means great depressions are over. That's the job. And that can be done. And, you know, people haven't seen it click in the past because it hasn't been promoted that way in the past. It wasn't as urgent in the past, but it's now urgent. We've got a gun against our head. People are talking about a depression. Depression means world war. World war in the nuclear era means game over. So we've got, I tell jokes, but it's not a joke. It's serious. We need advertising techniques to make bull markets, to make bull markets hateful. Bull markets are already hateful. We need to persuade people that bull markets are hateful. We need the public imagination to understand that bull markets are hateful. And we'll never have one again. Now, we'll have little bull markets, but we'll never have this insane stuff. And stock investing will be better than it's ever been before. Different and better than it's ever been before. You know, it's not going to be an even 6.5% every year. Some years, maybe it'll be 3, and some years, maybe it'll be 10. But we're not going to have 30% gains, and we're not going to have 50% losses if we do this. But I can't do it. You know, with all the words I have at my command, I can't make this happen. But as a community, yes, The community of middle-class investors can make it happen. Write your congressman. I wrote my congressman asking, I didn't ask for the stock thing so much, but I said we need help with the internet problem. So that, you know, because we had communities that wanted to do this. Motley Fool, Vanguard Diehards, Early Retirement Forum, IndexUniverse.com, the Fireboard, Safe Withdrawal Rate Research Group. We had communities that wanted to do this, that showed a desire. And they were crushed by thugs. And so I wrote for help with the thug problem. Well, write to your congressman, ask for help with the thug problem, or ask for help with this stock and, you know, the passive investing problem. Or go to, yeah, better yet, I mean, Congress is sort of slow, the way they act. Yeah, go to blogs. Blogs can change the world because blogs aren't, they don't have, blogs, you know, I'll tell you a secret about blogs. They don't pay a lot. You know, they don't pay a lot. So the blog owners, they don't have millions of dollars at risk if they tell the truth. They're going to lose if they tell the truth about stock investing. So blog owners are free to just let it out there. So tell your local blog owner. How about writing, you know, tell them contact Rob and he'll write some guest blog entries. Write some guest blog entries yourself, even better. Get the word out. Together we can do it. Community action. We got to the moon. We've done a lot on the environment. What else did we do? Can't remember. We tried to stop the war. Did we stop the war? Vietnam War? Yeah, we stopped the war. You know? We did all kinds of things. Disco. Stop disco. No more disco on the radio. So we can do this thing. You got to believe it yourself, of course. That's what all the materials are there so that there's a place where you can send your friends and say, you have doubts about this passive investing model? Go to Rob Bennett's site, passionsaving.com, and, you know, I wouldn't wish my worst enemy to listen to all his podcasts, but pick out a couple and you'll get the idea. Try the calculators. Give them a spin. And write some guest blog entries. Change the world. Change the world. Good luck with your investing strategies.